Well, today's message is divided into three parts: the preamble, the amble, and then I'm afraid the ramble. So get ready for it. The preamble. I found out something interesting about journalistic ethics. I found out that if I don't quote myself when quoting myself, I'm committing plagiarism against myself. I had no idea. I thought plagiarism was only when or if I were ever to steal somebody else's material and not quote it and give credit. But it turns out that I'm subject to my own. This is a daunting kind of responsibility for a journalist, but think how much more daunting it is for clergy. If we had to disclose every time we repeated ourselves or quoted ourselves or referenced a previous sermon, it would be all footnotes, folks. And politicians, too, if they were subject to the same standards of repeating the stump speech again and again. And they've got a double problem, because not only do they have plagiarism problems, but when somebody else is writing your speech and you're not giving credit, and then are you double plagiarizing, it gets very, very complicated. That's the preamble. The amble is I'm going to quote a story from my first book, Triple Axel Sperm Tests and Neutrinos. I wouldn't have given myself credit, except I read that thing on plagiarism. And it's a true story that I'll tell briefly because it's relevant to the topic. I was riding my camel, well, actually it was a Hertz Rent-A-Camel, across the Sahara in North Africa, and I was not happy. Camels look like they're gliding with ease across the desert sands. They're called ships of the desert. Well, I was on a very unsteady, ungainly ship. My camel, I was convinced, had three legs, all of differing lengths. While I looked at everyone else, and their camels were just gliding along, just as smooth as could be. And I was just uniquely cursed. And I suffered in silence. Part of this, the curse, was when you see films about people riding camels, usually they're in front of the hump and it looks relatively comfortable. Probably isn't, but in Tunisia, you rode behind the hump on the coccyx of the camel, which ground and ground into what is technically called the tush. And I found myself feeling uncomfortable, unhappy, and persecuted. When the long day ended and I got off of my Hertz Rent-A-Camel, I insisted with my guide, Sisala, that I had a defective camel and I wanted, by God, a new, not used camel in the morning. And I wanted it to have four legs, all the same length, and air conditioning and FM would have been good, too. All he could promise was a four-legged camel. So I mounted my four-legged camel the next morning. It got up, and sometime between my mounting it and its first step, it lost a leg. And strangely enough, as I looked at my old camel, it had grown a leg, and it was moving smoothly across the desert. I wanted to cry out in frustration, but I had the mild epiphany that everybody was riding a three-legged camel and everybody was looking at four-legged camels, that I was judging my inside dialogue, my inside, sometimes deep inside feelings, according to the outside of other people. I knew my story and I knew my pain, but I could not imagine theirs. Their lives, their trip, their journey on their caravan, their camel, were all good, and I was uniquely cursed. Well, of course, I wasn't. Those times being the times that they were with the macho code of silence, with John Wayne as my example and Gary Cooper in backup, with Teddy Roosevelt saying, "Speak softly and carry a big stick," I did not complain loudly and vociferously. Well, you all know that our Unitarian saint, Henry David Thoreau, said that most men lead lives of quiet desperation and go to their graves with their songs unsung. Those were the good old days when we led lives of quiet desperation. In our society today, many lead lives of extraordinarily loud desperation, where our desperation is not simply kept inside, and I'm not going to make an argument that we should swallow our emotions, so stay with me on this, but our emotions are not kept inside. Many just think it is our job to be vigorously and rigorously truthful with each other in every moment, or the moment becomes inauthentic. That you have a right, yea, a duty, to be part of my taking of my emotional temperature 24 hours a day. I owe you my candor at every moment. That's a hard way to build a community, a relationship, and a family. We take, as a society, much of our desperation and we blog it. We Facebook it. We show up on what I call humilitainment, which is going to court shows or talk shows where we can share our anger, our rage, our fear, our dysfunction in a very public and, in my mind, not terribly helpful manner. And Schadenfreude, the joy and pleasure that we get in other people's pain, becomes part of our society. Now, almost every social ill that you can think of, and probably some that you can't, all of these have been blamed on my generation, which is to say the generation of the 60s, because we are said to have taken our desperation and confused communication with rudeness and honesty with incivility. It was our generation that has caused all of the problems of the world. The breakdown of the nuclear family. We were anti-nuke even back then. The breakdown of respect for the great institutions that that really define our society, of government, of religious institutions, of family institutions. Everything has been broken down because our generation decided to tell everything like it is, or as we felt it was in any given moment. Of course, these are hideous generalizations, and our stories and our manners are not all that different, but we did change part of the ideal, that taciturnity, the idea that we just suffer in silence, and men keep their feelings to themselves. This was a time when men didn't share and women weren't allowed to share. And we've made progress from then. We actually communicate in a lot of ways better. And some of our hymns this morning talked about how we can resolve this seeming tension between sharing everything and believing that incivility equals truth, and taking our emotional temperature and sharing it 24 hours a day is a good thing, and the other extreme of just bearing everything silently with unbearable courage. How are you? I'm fine. What's wrong? Nothing. We know that's not a good way of doing things. We also know that for those of you who saw August in Osage County, or The Wild Duck by Ibsen, or Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, that just unbridled honesty, which is, or really hostility that is being masked as honesty, is not the answer either. The question becomes, in a society where desperation is no longer silent, How do we find some kind of moving balance in trying to figure out how to share important truths with each other? How not simply to build up not masks so much as layers of protection that keep us from intimacy without walking around emotionally naked and vulnerable all the time. These are issues that the great artists of the Western world and probably the Eastern, Northern, and Southern world have always dealt with, because they're not either or. Eugene O'Neill, in his wonderful and incredibly difficult dialogue of the great God Brown, has his main character, Dion, covered in armor and afraid to take the armor off because he's afraid of the vulnerability of touch and truth. Somewhere between growing a carapace out of fear of intimacy and mistaking emotional oozing over everyone for intimacy, there is a reasoned way of trying to proceed, not perfectly, but carefully and gently in the world. It is in figuring out who has your trust and the rightful expectation of intimacy. With whom can we and should we share our fears, our desires, our passions, our phobias, our strengths, our vulnerabilities? Not with the entire world, but with people who have, through honest relationship and, as our hymn said, through forgiveness and patience, earned our trust, earned the right to our measured vulnerability. One of the most important things that was ever said to me in a mentoring relationship was when I was conducting my first funeral. I was 24 years old, I believe. I had never been to a Unitarian funeral or a Unitarian Universalist funeral, and a man whom I married to his second wife died on the honeymoon. And I got a call at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and I expressed an honest sentiment, which was vulgar and made my reputation because it was honest. And I came to the ceremony, which was at Star King Unitarian Church in Hayward. And here was the new widow and her family. And here was the former wife and their children. And he had belonged to a synagogue, and so his old rabbi was there. And as a virgin, clerically speaking anyway, I went to Rabbi Zucker and I asked with all the articulateness I could, what do I say? And he said, I will tell you. Tell the truth nicely. Wow. You know, beside the sampler of we need not think alike to love alike, if ever there were a motto for clergy, for parents, for children, for family, for communities, it is tell the truth nicely. Candor doesn't have to be unkind. When somebody says, you know, John, I got to tell you, usually it's not going to follow with, you're looking fabulous today. Boy, that was a hell of a sermon. And I found that when somebody says, you know, John, I got to tell you, I think, do you really? Do you really? Because the preface kind of sets up what's going to follow from this. And I think that we all have important truths, important pains, important insecurities that we need to share with one another. A sense of intimacy with somebody in this world who we can trust with, if not our deepest secrets, at least some of our secrets, is important for the health of the soul. But let us not confuse candor with emotional violence. These are things to be considered. Back to North Africa, but not the caravan. I live in a house that did not have a telephone, and there were no cell phones. I did not have a refrigerator, did not have air conditioning. I did not have a car. I had to carry heavy gas on my shoulder on a bicycle to and from town in order to cook food and another bottle for the heat. I lived in what in this country would have been abject, if not poverty, it was a standard of living that if I lived here with that, I'd be a revolutionary, and my desperation would be deep and probably loud. Over there, I was living in paradise. Did I mention that the house was on the beach, on the Mediterranean? Context means something here. I was in paradise because nobody else had those things either. My poverty, my lack of things, was not a function of something absolute, but relative to what I saw others having. And so often when we're looking at our lives, we think that our problems are the telephone, the heating, the car, the thingness that we are missing. And we look at somebody else's standards of living and we judge them and judge ourselves and think that those things convey happiness. We have fears and they are righteous. We have fears of loss, of life, of love, of health. We have fears of deprivation of certain things and the erosion of freedom and of hope and a sense of what kind of world we are going to create and pass on to our children. There are things worthy of being afraid of. But most of the things that grab us and get us are those things that when we look at how others live, we assume that they are conferring happiness upon those people, and then we judge their outsides against our insides. The things are not the things that fill us. The things that fill us are those relationships of intimacy and of trust that we create that allow us to share. Not simply desperation, but insecurity and hope and joy and uncertainty and all of those things for which we strive and we sometimes fear failure in striving for. The most important issue for me in this society where desperation has grown loud is that desperation is unfocused and it's about stuff that often just isn't important. So as so many things, I think that healing and judgment come when we take a look at what is important to us in our lives, what values do we hold, what people do we want to share our journey with, and who is it that will listen and appreciate and correct our song. We all do have a song. Everybody in the world has a story worth telling and a song worth singing, but often not on the street corner. And you have to find the appropriate audience, the appropriate persons and people and community that have earned your trust and the expectation of intimacy. I think that's the great social job from which we get strength and give strength and build the courage to engage in the repair of this beautiful, beautiful world.